Today's video might make your brain hurt, but I always think that that is a good thing. I'm interviewing my friend Dr. Neil Shenvey about his new book, Why Believe? A Reasoned Approach to Christianity. Now, I know what you might be thinking. Melissa, why do I need another apologetics book on my shelf? And guys, I'm here to tell you, for the same reason why we all need more books on our shelf. Am I right? I would have to consider this particular book quite unique among other apologetic books that I have read. The reason why is that it comes from Dr. Neil Shenvey. Now, if that means nothing to you, then I implore you to watch this interview because, in my opinion, this man is brilliant. I really enjoy the way that he describes things, tough concepts that a lot of Christians wrestle with. I think that he does a very good job of explaining these concepts in a very theological, philosophical way. Personally, I enjoy that because sometimes I don't understand certain things, and there is one topic in his book that I personally wanted him to zone in on, and that is his chapter on morality. It is chapter 5, and I pored over this chapter. The moral argument is of fascination to me. The moral argument is something that apologists use to argue for the existence of God. But why? Why is that an argument to begin with? A lot of people may not understand why this is a great thing to know and to have in your arsenal as a Christian that you can really understand. I mentioned a fancy word before in a few of my other videos called prolegomena, and it's just a fancy word for the things before the things. Whenever you're talking about spiritual matters with somebody, you get into certain things before you get into the Bible or Jesus. I mean, does God exist? Are miracles possible? How can you explain morality? What about the design of the universe? You know, these are things that a lot of apologists are very well versed in, especially with atheists. And I find a lot of value in knowing, in particular, the moral argument. This is just my opinion, and I could be wrong and I could change my mind in a few years from now, but as of now, during the time of this interview, I think that this is one of the most valuable things that Christians can share with a non-believer is how to explain the moral argument and why that is evidence for a God. And then you lead into why that fits the Christian God. So there's a lot of topics that Neil covers in his book. It's not just morality. He goes over in the beginning of this video what those topics are, and I will leave a link in the description of this video for you to check out his book. I hope you get it, and I hope you enjoy it, and I also hope that you enjoyed this interview. Hi guys, I'm really excited to have my friend Dr. Neil Shenvey on my channel today to talk about his new book, Why Believe? A Reasoned Approach to Christianity. Dr. Neil Shenvey, thank you so much for coming on my channel today to talk about your book.
Thank you, Melissa.
Yeah. So can you tell my audience about who you are and why you would write a book like this?
Well, I am Dr. Neil Shenvey, and I got an undergraduate degree in chemistry from Princeton. And then when I was not a Christian at the time, I became a Christian while I was doing my graduate work at UC Berkeley, where I got my PhD in theoretical chemistry. And then I went on to do a postdoc at Yale and work as a research scientist at Duke. But I actually quit my job at Duke about 7 or 8 years ago to homeschool our 4 kids. So right now I'm a homeschooling theoretical chemist with a new book out from Crossway.
That's a triple threat there, Neil. That's amazing. Yeah, I remember last time you and I had an interview, and nobody ever saw this interview because I had such tech issues. So just so my audience knows, I would love to have Neil back on my channel to talk about CRT, which is another subject which he is qualified in. So but about this book, the first thing that I thought when I got it in the mail and I read it was another apologetics book, right? What makes this one different?
And as you can see, I have a whole shelf behind me of apologetics books, and it's a good question. You know, I kind of collector here. So
same, right?
Why did I write one? And the short answer, why did I write the book? Well, it's because I'm cheap. So I was giving away free copies of Tim Keller's book, Reason for God, when I was a postdoc at Yale. I was giving away at a Campus Crusade for Christ or Crew book table. And I was like, I can't keep doing this. This is getting expensive. So yeah. I thought to myself, you know, maybe I should write my own book at some point that I can give away cheaper. And so that was that sort of the seed of the idea that I'd write my own book. And then when I moved to North Carolina, I think 12 years ago now, mm-hmm. some of my elders at my church were encouraging me, yeah, definitely write a book on your own. Mm-hmm. And so, but what makes my book unique or interesting among all these great resources we have? And so number one, I wanted to make it accessible to everybody. So the material that I teach, when I teach a class to teenagers, so 7th graders through 12th graders, I teach a class on apologetics for them at boot camp, but I use this material in that class. So it's accessible to motivated high school students.
Wonderful.
I'm a theoretical chemist, which sounds very technical, but part of my job was to be able to create good analogies, models, thought experiments, and to convey complex ideas to everyday people. And so I try to do that in the book. So it's accessible to, mm-hmm. I'd say, to motivated high school students, college students. But also, secondly, I wanted it to be intellectual. That was the hard balance to strike. So there are a lot of great books out there that are accessible. Lee Strobel's Case for Christ, I love it. I love J. Warner Wallace's book, mm-hmm. Cold Case Christianity. But I would not feel comfortable handing those books to my professors or my colleagues at a university, at a college setting, not because they're not good resources, but because, like, take Cold Case Christianity. Mm-hmm. I like that book a lot. But you open it up and it's got hand-drawn cartoons in it. Mm-hmm. And they're helpful. They really are. But if I gave that to a professor at like Duke or Princeton, they'd say, what is this? This is a cartoon. And so they wouldn't bother even reading it. So my book, when you open it up, it's got footnotes. I interact very heavily with top atheist scholars like Bart Ehrman, mm-hmm. John Dominic Cross in the Jesus Seminar, Paula Fredrickson, Sean Carroll, a physicist. So I really interact with high level atheist scholars writing in various subjects. And so I feel like it comes across as a book written by someone who's done their homework, who's really listened to the other side. Third thing is it's very gospel centered. So I didn't want to write a book about how God exists and how some vague theism is true. I wanted to write a book that argued for the truth of Christianity. Mm-hmm. So my book is structured around four major arguments that all lead to the conclusion that Christianity is true, that God exists in general, but that Christianity is true. And then fourth thing is it's comprehensive. So I walk through things like the trilemma. Obviously, Jesus is Lord, liar, lunatic, the resurrection, and it's evidence for the resurrection. I talk about arguments for God's existence. Can miracles happen? If I'm a scientist, how can I believe in miracles? I deal with objections to Christianity, the problem of evil, evolution, divine hiddenness. And then I talk about why the gospel itself is the best argument for the objective truth of Christianity. So all of that is sort of the outline of what I discussed. It's pretty wide ranging. And then finally, I've been told by readers that my scientific background is very evident in how I write.
Yes.
Again, it's not technical. There's not a lot of science per se in the book. There's history, there's theology, there's philosophy, but they said it's very systematic. Mm-hmm. The way I approach problems is, in a linear fashion. I make an argument, I raise counter arguments, I respond to the counter arguments. And so they said, yeah, you can tell that you're a scientist. So I pitch my book as Keller's Reason for God for STEM majors. It's science, technology, engineering, mathematics, yeah, majors. Hopefully even English majors will find it interesting. But I think it strikes you as written by someone who's very analytically minded, I hope.
It does. Yes. And even in the way you explained that just now was very linear.
That's right. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5.
Right. Yes. Very Neil, about how you did it. And I tend to gravitate towards writing styles where you can take a complicated topic and you have somebody who's talented enough to make it understandable to the masses. It's like the difference between, if like Einstein was explaining physics compared to like a, what is that physicist, Michio Kaku, I believe his name is.
Oh, yeah. I've
brilliant man. But when he explains physics, I get it.
Yeah.
You know, I feel like he can take objects. I think that's good apologetics.
Yeah. And one of the good things about becoming a Christian, I think, later in life was that I never lost that sense of how I would have responded, yes. Right? I can totally remember how I would have objected to that very claim. And so then it's in the back of my head. Well, here's how I'd explain it to 20-year-old Neil.
Yes. I think that it's good for my audience to know that is a good thing to know you're not entertaining, like, you know, giving your mind over to the enemy. It's critical thinking whenever you can actually look ahead and see what your opponent might be thinking so that you can give a response as well. It's critical thinking. It's good thinking.
Sure.
Yeah. And on that note, so you just went over all these topics that you cover in your book. There was a lot. I had to really think about what I wanted to zone in on. And the one topic that, I don't know, maybe I need to think about more. Like, I get it, but there's an element of it that I am still kind of happily wrestling with. I think it's an apologist thing where we kind of like to wrestle with these topics because it helps us think better about them. And one thing in your book is chapter 5, which is the argument for morality, the moral law. And that's really what I'm going to focus in on. And you knew this, but my audience doesn't, but I really want to focus in on that chapter in this interview so that people can understand. First, you've written a brilliant book about all these topics, but one topic in general that I think my audience can really get a lot out of is this. So first, to ask you about certain topics within this chapter, on page 117, you mentioned that even atheists concede that if God doesn't exist, then morality cannot exist either. This might go over some people's heads when they hear that, but I'm wondering if you could break this down. Why would anyone consider morality to be proof of God's existence?
Right. Yeah. So actually, atheists tend to be divided. So you'll see if I lay out the moral argument, there are two premises. And so the conclusion is God exists. So atheists can't affirm that. But to avoid that conclusion, they have to deny one of these two premises, these two ideas. And so some atheists would deny that you need God for morality. They'd say, no, you can have morality without God. So they would say that. And other atheists would say, no, you need God for morality, but therefore morality does not exist. So here's the argument. I'll set it up for you, and I'll explain why we would think that morality is evidence for God. So the argument's this. It's very standard. William Lane Craig talks about it. Actually, C.S. Lewis, it's the main subject in his book, Mere Christianity.
Yeah, okay.
It's definitely not my idea. Premise one, if God does not exist, then objective moral values and duties do not exist. That's premise one, first premise. Premise two, objective moral values and duties do, in fact, exist. Therefore, the conclusion is God exists. So it's a valid argument, meaning that if the premises are both true, then the conclusion follows logically from the premises.
Yeah.
So the question then is, well, are both premises true? And so obviously atheists have to either deny premise one or premise two or both. And here's the funny thing, just right off the bat, you can find very well-known intellectual prominent atheists who affirm premise one or premise two independently. So some atheists affirm premise one. That's right. If God doesn't exist, then objective moral values and duties do not exist. They affirm that. Other atheists say, no, I actually reject that premise. I affirm premise two, though. I think that objective moral values and duties do exist without God. So you can find atheists. So the point is this. If those atheists are being rational, then it's rational to accept both premises, unless you have some other independent reason to think God's a fantasy. But if it's rational, premise one and premise two are both defensible and rational, well, then it makes sense for someone to say, well, put them together, God exists. So right off the bat, you're like, okay, at least it means that I can't do that. Just check my brain at the door and abandon reason to be a Christian or to be at least believe in God. So let's go into premises now. So we talked about, yes, well, how can you say that if God does not exist, there's no morality? How can you say that? Well, and people do say that. So let me give you three major atheists who believe that. So Jean-Paul Sartre is a famous atheist, French philosopher, existentialist. And he says this, God does not exist. And all possibility of finding values in a heaven of ideas disappears along with him. everything is permissible if God does not exist. Mm-hmm. So he's saying you can have subjective personal preferences for things. I can like compassion. I can like kindness. I can like honesty personally, subjectively, but there's no objective moral value saying that apart from my preference or your preference or everybody's preferences, compassion is objectively good. Apart from anybody, any human being's preferences. So he says, yeah, I agree. If God doesn't exist, there's no heaven of ideas that ground these moral values. Therefore, there are no such values. Here's J.L. Mackey, a famous philosopher. He says, moral facts constitute so odd a cluster of qualities and relations. They're so strange that they are most unlikely to have arisen in the ordinary course of events without an all-powerful God to create them. So what does he mean by that? He says, think about this. And this is his reasoning. Mm-hmm. When you say something is an obligation, you ought to do this, you ought to do that, you should do this, you should not do that. Those are called imperatives. They're things that you ought to do, but they're not conditional. They're not statements about, oh, if you want this outcome, then you ought to do this. So you'd say, well, if you want to, say, become a clown, you ought to go to clown school. Right? That's a conditional. Or if you want to win this game of chess, you ought to take their queen. Those are conditional imperatives. Mm-hmm. But Mackey says, wait a minute. But when I say you ought to love your neighbor or you ought not to murder people, right? That's not conditional. You can't be like, well, I'm not playing the moral game. Like, there's no opting out of the moral game. So they're immediately, supposedly, these moral facts, like this is good, this is bad, you ought to do this, you ought not to do that, those give you reasons to act that are totally independent of your own personal goals. He's like, that's bizarre, right? I can understand saying if you want this goal, then you ought to do that. That makes sense. But where are these unconditional obligations come from if not from an all-powerful authority like God? Mm-hmm. So that's his reasoning. And finally, philosopher Joel Marx, who's a modern contemporary philosopher, he's an atheist. And he, in an article, he talks about how he used to be what he called sort of a soft atheist, meaning that he thought, in his mind, that you could be an atheist and still believe in objective morality. So he believed that. But finally, he says, you know, I've come to realize that's not true. He says this, a soft atheist, like he once was, would hold that one could be an atheist and still believe in morality. But the religious fundamentalists are correct. Without God, there is no morality. So he actually changed his mind and said, no, the crazy fundamentalists, they were right all along. If there's no God, and he's still an atheist, but he's like, if I am no longer a moralist, a moral realist. So there's some atheists who have come to the same conclusion. And then, of course, I'll just more briefly, there are atheists who do the opposite. They say, no, you can totally have morality without God. So, for example, Bertrand Russell says the question of whether a moral code is good or bad is the same as the question of whether or not it promotes human happiness. So he's grounding moral facts in happiness and human happiness, human flourishing. Sam Harris, atheist, new atheist, neuroscientist, says questions of right and wrong are really questions about the happiness and suffering of sentient creatures with consciousness. Mm-hmm. If we're in the position to affect the happiness of or suffering of others, we have ethical responsibilities towards them. And actually, like the majority of philosophers, according to a famous survey, the majority of people who have a position on moral facts, 2-1 favor them. So most philosophers, more philosophers favor the existence of objective moral facts than those who deny them. So they're also, and most of them are atheists. So again, there are atheists who would say, no, you can totally have morality without God, and it's grounded somewhere else. It's not referring to God or God's commands, it's referring to human happiness, say. Anyway, so those are the two ways an atheist can escape the argument, either by saying you can have morality without God, or by saying, admitting, no, you need God, therefore there is no morality. And one last thing, I know I'm talking a lot.
Yeah, no, this is great. Yeah.
The one thing that happens all the time, mm-hmm, when you bring up this argument with atheists is they think you're insulting them. They're like, how dare you call me a bad, immoral person? That's just slanderous. And I gotta emphasize here, we're not saying atheists can't behave morally. In fact, the Bible says the God's law is written on our hearts. So we know right from wrong. Mm-hmm. God's inscribed his law there. And so atheists can behave morally. They can do things that are relatively good in the sense that all of us are, we're not that good anyway. None of us are. Christians, non-Christians, we're all in the end corrupt through sin. But I'd say, yeah, absolutely atheists can do, can engage in morally good behavior just like a Christian can. The question is, can you explain where the category of morality comes from if God doesn't exist? That's the question. So here's a good analogy.
Yeah.
Imagine the category of soul or mind, this immaterial part of our person. So Christians believe in a soul or a mind that's not identical to our physical bodies, not identical to our brains. There's this other part of us. Mm-hmm. Now imagine me making the argument, if nature is all that exists, just the material physical stuff, if that's true, then souls don't exist. Mm-hmm. Premise two, but souls do exist. Therefore what? Therefore nature is not all that exists. Imagine that argument, right? It's parallel to the moral argument.
Yes.
Now, could a naturalist say, how dare you, sir? You don't believe I have a soul? I'm just a soulless zombie, a mindless? I'm like, no. I'm not saying that. I'm saying if nature is all that exists, then souls don't exist, but souls do exist. You have one, I have, we all have one.
Yeah.
I'm asking whether naturalism can explain that category of thing called a soul. In the same way, can atheism explain that category called morality? Where does it come from? Why does it exist? Mm-hmm. So that's the argument. Not that you're a zombie or soulless, or not that you're immoral, just that does that category exist without God?
This is all so fascinating, you know, and it's interesting because say you were debating an atheist, whenever you have somebody that, you know, is an atheist and they are consistent with their beliefs and they believe that morality is subjective, right? So it's not objective. Maybe it's cultural, which I'll get to that in a second. I want to ask you about that. But how would they define morality? So we have a moral law, and we know as Christians that there's a sort of illumination in God's word about morality, especially in Romans, right?
Yeah.
So you'll say, well, if the Bible didn't exist, then you would not be saying that sex before marriage was wrong, or that even homosexuality is wrong, or all these other things, right? So if it's written on our heart and say nobody had access to the Bible, we would still, at least the Ten Commandments, understand that these things are wrong. So if you were to have an atheist kind of throw that at you, right? How would you define what morality is? Because for a lot of them, they are saying that, well, Christians are saying that having sex with whoever you want, for example, is immoral, but you only believe that because of the Bible. So if you didn't have the Bible, how would you understand what's moral or not? Does that make sense?
One thing I'd point out, so the question of whether or not there's a category called morality, there's a category of moral good and moral evil and right and wrong, is different than what goes in that category. So we're saying even simpler than, well, what exactly is good and bad? What things, what actions are good, what actions are bad? Mm-hmm. We're taking a step back and saying, is there even a category called good and bad? And so you could even grant, and I wouldn't grant this, but you could grant that we have no idea what goes in those categories. But there's a category called good and bad. That's all we have to show. We don't have to show what goes in the category. Now, that said, I do think God's law is written on our hearts. And actually, interestingly, there's a great book I appealed to in Why Believe, Steven Pinker's book, The Blank Slate. He's an atheist psychologist at Harvard. And in his book, The Blank Slate, in the appendix, he has a list of human universals. These are things that anthropologists find in every culture across history, everywhere in the world, and there's like a list of like, it's like dozens of things like division of labor, I'm gonna think all the things like use of tools, use of language, basic things that all humans exhibit. But some of those categories are fascinating because one of those categories are the difference between right and wrong and good and evil. That's universal for human beings. We all have categories of morality and certain moral, you know, beliefs like, well, what goes in the category of evil? Murder is wrong in every culture universally. Rape is wrong in every culture. And here's the funny thing. Literally, the side-by-side elements that are universally true of all cultures. The first is rape is prohibited. It's wrong, right? Mm-hmm. The next thing on the list is rape happens. So it's, wow, Romans 1. We have God's law in our hearts, and we break that law. Those are both universal human experiences throughout all cultures. Now, so the point is, number one, I'd say, as an atheist, you have to do more than just show there's disagreement over moral facts. You have to argue there's no moral facts at all of any kind. There's no category called right and wrong. That's a heavy order. But two, I'd just point to the testimony of culture and say, look, you're going to find me one or two cultures that pink or mist, where they think murder is awesome and rape's awesome. Maybe, I don't know. But again, we're talking about, I'd say, 99% of cultures, if I grant there's some exceptions I don't know about. And C.S. Lewis, actually, in The Abolition of Man, C.S. Lewis has an appendix where he goes through various moral codes from all over ancient history. Mm-hmm. The Babylonians, I forget, he just lists all these different legal codes and moral prescriptions, and he points out how similar they are. They sound like the Ten Commandments. Mm-hmm. And that's, again, the Bible says, because God's written his laws in our hearts. So that's the first thing I'd say is, look, the atheist has to do more than just say there's disagreement, because, you know, there's disagreement over physical facts. Mm-hmm. There are people out there who believe the earth is flat. They really do. They're totally wrong, but they exist. Mm-hmm. But could you say, well, look, some people, like 0.001% of the U.S. in the 21st century believes in a flat earth, right? Therefore, there's no flatness or roundness that's not even a category. Who knows what's true? Say, no, wait a minute. There is a truth of the matter about the earth's shape. There is a fact of the matter. And more than that, the agreement is tremendous. So I'm arguing in the same way, there is a category of truth pertaining to morality. Some things are right, some things are wrong. And history and anthropology shows there's a lot of agreement, vast amounts of agreement on what goes in those two buckets. So I think what's more common, though, is that they really have to just say, well, it's all just cultural. It's all relative. Even though cultures tend to agree on these things, they're still mistaken. There's not really this category of morality. So that's what they have to go that far and say, no, it's all an illusion. So that's what they would probably say in the end.
Yeah. So it was an off the beaten path question, but I was thinking of that mm-hmm. when you were explaining that. Now, speaking of culture, on page 116, it says this, quote, "The most common way to argue that moral facts can exist in the absence of God, on an atheist perspective, is to ground morality in temporal human flourishing. Behaviors that cause people to suffer are immoral, and those which benefit people are moral," end quote. Can you explain the major flaws with that view?
Right. And so you saw that appeal to human flourishing or human happiness in Bertrand Russell and Sam Harris and mm-hmm. other atheists. That's the most common thing to say is, well, when we say morality and good and evil, we're just talking about human happiness. And so if they appealed to that, that's at least objective. You can measure, or at least there's some fact of the matter about human happiness. So they're saying, no, objective moral facts do exist. They're affirming that. But they're denying you need God for it. What they're saying is it's grounded not in God's character or his commands. Rather, moral facts are objective. They are, but they're grounded in people being happy or people flourishing, which is sort of a broader category than just happiness. So people, mm-hmm. you know, being healthy and well-fed and having friendships and meaning in life. And well, all of that is, you measure all of that stuff, human flourishing, and that's what is we talk about when we mean morality. Morality means achieving a state that is the maximum number of people is flourishing. Mm-hmm. Now, what's the problem with that view? I think there are lots of problems. So number one, this is a consistent problem throughout history. How do you adjudicate between the flourishing of groups and the flourishing of individuals? So simple example, imagine you have a society mm-hmm. that you can design a society where people are flourishing, they're happy, they're fulfilled, they're healthy, they have plenty to eat. So 99% of society is flourishing, but 1% are enslaved. The reason the whole society is flourishing, the 99% are flourishing, is because they've enslaved the 1%, and the 1% lead miserable, tortured lives. There's actually a science fiction novel by what's her name? Ursula Le Guin, I think. And it's about I think it's called The Ones Who Left Omelas, and it envisions this exact problem. She imagines this society was totally happy and fun-loving, and everyone's just full of joy and pleasure. But the way they get that society is by basically torturing a child. And the only way they can achieve that happiness for all these people is one solitary person, is one child is locked in a basement and basically tortured. And she asks, is that a good society? And she says, and in her fictional work, some people just accept that. And they're like, okay, well, that's the deal. I guess so. And others just abandon it. They're like, I can't handle this. Just even one innocent sufferer. You can't trade even all that happiness for one person who's suffering. So the problem is, if you're going to say morality is grounded, so what it means to be moral is to achieve a flourishing society. And what is moral is what leads to that state of flourishing. Well, how do you weigh the needs of the many versus the needs of the few? Mm-hmm. Why not enslave a handful of people or an ethnic group if it can make everyone's lives happier? That's a big problem, because throughout history, we've seen human beings will easily trample on individuals for the greater good. That's a theme in one of the Harry Potter's things. For the greater good, we're doing all this terrible stuff for the greater good. But here's the problem. If the greater good is identical with the good, then torturing the innocent and killing and mass murders and genocide, all those things, if they actually lead to the greater good, if they really do, that's moral. You're obligated to do that. You're obligated to kill and lie and torture if it truly does produce a flourishing society. So that's a big problem. Here's another problem. How do you deal with things like lying? Because lying can actually end up producing a state where people are happy based on the lie. So and they'll get into this later, I'm sure. But the example I give in my book is, imagine that, if you are married and you have multiple affairs with multiple mistresses and lie about those affairs to your wife. I mean, look, your wife's happy because she doesn't know you're cheating on her. Your mistresses are all happy because you're a good philanderer, I guess. And you're happy because you get to have lots of promiscuous sex. Yeah. So on the view that morality is identical with human flourishing, and if everyone seems to be flourishing on that view, then not only is that a good thing to have affairs and then lie to your wife would be a good thing, it'd actually be morally obligatory because you're maximizing people's happiness. Now, good luck explaining that to your wife, right? But my point is, clearly there are things that you can do that seem to maximize happiness and yet are truly wicked things. And so that's another problem with this idea that human flourishing and morality are identical. And then the final thing, and this is a problem, again, philosophers have raised all these problems before. There are many more than this. I'll just give you three. Is what's known as the epistemic problem, which means how you know what is moral. So there's a lot of epistemic uncertainty, meaning if morality is grounded in what leads to the ultimate, the maximal flourishing of the most people in the future, it's not like right now, because of course we do things today that happen to have effects tomorrow. So morality is, you have to look at it in the future too. What are my actions going to do in terms of consequences in a week, in a month, in a year? Here's the problem. If morality is measured by what happens eventually in the future, long-term future, well, then how can I ever know what's actually good? So here's an example people have talked about. Is it good to murder a baby? Just murder a baby. You're like, well, no, that's the most horrible thing I could think of, is murdering a newborn baby. It's pure evil. What if that baby would have grown up to be a murderer or a rapist or a genocidal maniac? Well, then it would, because it's clearly, he's going to diminish people's flourishing in many ways. So in that case, it would be actually good to promote human flourishing by killing that baby. But you're like, well, I can't know. That's exactly right. You can't know whether any act in the long term is going to produce the state of affairs that is good or bad. We can't predict things that far. We can't predict things a day in the future, let alone a year, 10 years, 20 years. So you're like, I have no idea. And actually, even Peter Singer admits this at one point in his books. He's like, yeah, it's really hard to know. You make your best guess. You just do what you hope is going to lead to. And you might find out, I did this thing thinking it was the right thing to do, but it turned out that it led to a lot of misery. And so it ended up being the incredibly immoral thing to do. You're not following rules. Like, this is, murder is wrong. Thou shalt not murder. Thou shalt not steal. Thou shalt not commit adultery. You're not doing that. You're just saying, what are the consequences? And the problem is, you can't know the consequences in many cases. So those are three big problems: groups versus individuals, lying leading to flourishing, and then, of course, epistemic uncertainty. You can't know what's going to happen in even the near future, let alone the distant future, in terms of your actions. So you can't then measure what is good and evil in the here and now.
Yeah, that was fascinating. You know what it reminds me of is Brave New World on many levels when it comes to human flourishing, but there's still a lot of immoral things going on.
And then in the Brave New World, how do they solve that problem? It's by brainwashing the epsilons and the lower castes. They brainwash them into thinking they're happy. And so you could even argue, well, actually, although Huxley intended it as a dystopia, a horrifying future, but on a utilitarian view, everyone is pretty content because they've been brainwashed. The only person who's unhappy is John Savage because he's not been brainwashed.
Yeah.
So most people look at that book and they're like, that's horrifying. And yet, why is that not the ultimate human flourishing utopia?
And you mentioned utilitarianism. I'm glad you mentioned that because you know who else I was thinking of whenever you were talking is, have you ever seen Avengers Endgame?
Yeah, Thanos. That's right.
Yes. It makes Thanos correct.
Yeah, there's a Twitter handle. Right, there's a Twitter account called Thanos Did Nothing Wrong. Yes. They're like, look, guys, the whales came back to the Atlantic Ocean in Manhattan, and he was right. All these people could have had much better lives. But he murdered literally half of the universe. But again, he's a rational utilitarian in some sense.
Yes.
And what does he say? And he kills Gamora. Oh, spoiler alert! But he kills his daughter. Mm-hmm. Sometimes the hardest choices require the strongest wills. He does it for the greater good. He kills his own daughter. Mm-hmm. But it's because he's not going to let one person's happiness stand in the way of a trillion people's happiness.
Yeah.
So what did he do? If you're a utilitarian, show me why Thanos was wrong there.
Yeah. You know, and for people that have no idea what we're talking about, it's a Christian ethic, utilitarian. Can you briefly describe that, what that means? Because in Christian ethics, you go over these types of moralities and there's a whole variety of them, but I believe there's six of them. And I recommend Norman Geisler's Christian ethics book. It breaks these down really well. Can you explain to my audience what that word means?
Yeah, utilitarianism is an ethical theory that basically says the ethics in right and wrong, good and evil are grounded in utility, meaning basically human flourishing. However you define that, human utility, what produces, and it's usually the greatest good for the greatest number. You can't make everybody happy, but you try to maximize human race's utility, and maybe even you try to maximize the utility of all sentient creatures and be like the, you know, apes and chimpanzees and dolphins are kind of smart. And so maybe, and there's some cutoff though. You obviously don't maximize utility of like plants. But that's the ethical theory that says ultimately good and evil are matters of making there's some class. And here's the other problem. Yeah. Where is the line?
Exactly.
So you draw the line to, well, I don't want to make plants happy. Plants can't be happy. Okay. Well, dolphins, dolphins. But wait a minute, why I don't want to include dolphins. That's silly. What about apes? No, not apes either. What about mentally disabled human beings? This is where you get people like Peter Singer saying, well, they shouldn't really count either because they're not really fully human. They're not fully persons, he would say. And so in some, maybe in some cases, Singer would argue it's moral to actually kill an infant, not a preborn
person. I was just going to ask you about that. It's the same situation.
Yeah, he's famous infamous for arguing there are cases in which it's actually moral to kill a toddler. I'm not talking about even newborns, but below some age, he does not believe that human beings, say it's around age even like two, they don't perceive themselves continuing through time. It's cut off, and therefore, prior to age two or so, they're not persons. And so it can be moral for various reasons to murder, or he would say kill toddlers for some greater good. Or even, and this is where he gets in real trouble, severely handicapped people, he would argue maybe should be killed or euthanized in order for some greater good to be achieved. Yeah.
It would be a burden on society.
Yeah. And I think the ones I've heard him, I haven't heard him ever say for the good of society, it's a burden. And actually, interestingly, I saw an interview with him where someone confronted him about these views, and he's defending it very philosophically. Well, here's the arguments for it. And they said, so on your view, some people, it's not, you know, you're taking resources away from, say, the hungry people in Africa to divert to these people that are just big sucks on our resources. So you should give the resources to people that are starving, dozens of them in Africa, rather than spending them on people that are disabled here. It's like, yeah. And they said, well, isn't your mother in a nursing home? And don't you pay for her care? And he pauses and he says, well, sometimes these are hard to work out in practice.
Mm-hmm.
So you're looking at your, so you see that, again, well, Christians would say the law of God is pulling on his heart mm-hmm. and saying, you know, this is wrong. And yeah. he can't bring himself to actually live by his own theories mm-hmm. because he, of course, supports his mother in the nursing home when he could be giving that money to people that are starving in Africa. So anyway, but he's a high profile ethicist, a philosophy professor at Princeton, actually, who believes he's a utilitarian.
Very interesting. And I think it's good, you know, for people watching to see why this is such a strong argument for just the existence of God is morality, because you're literally looking at an Avengers movie, you know, like Thanos situation without some sort of moral law. A few more questions for you. And it was really hard to choose in your chapter which ones I wanted to pinpoint on. But these were just very interesting to me. A few times you've mentioned, again, the cultural aspect of this. And on page 118, you talk about what's called cultural and ethical relativism. I thought this was very interesting. Can you explain what these are and why they're extremely problematic?
Sure. So as I use the terms, cultural relativism refers to saying that good and evil are relative to a culture. So they're not objective across all cultures, but there's no fact of whether some action is good or evil to all cultures. It's good to this culture and it's evil to that culture. There's no objective fact of whether some action is good or evil. It's all relative to some culture. Mm-hmm. And again, there are problems with this view. Here's the two big ones. One is the reformer problem. So let's say you have some culture like, you know, U.S. culture in the 19th century or the 20th century, under slavery or under Jim Crow. Now, in those cultures, there were reformers who were calling the United States culture to repent and to adopt a new standard and say, this slavery is wicked. Jim Crow laws are wrong. And so you have people, you have abolitionists, you have people like Dr. Martin Luther King. You know, there were reformers, there were moral reformers who were saying, no, we need to change the culture's standards. Here's the problem. If you think that good and evil are relative to culture, then those reformers were evil because they were doing what was evil in the sight of the culture. There is no transcultural standard by which they are judged to be good. The culture is itself the standard. Mm-hmm. So all moral reformers, whether they're opposing infanticide in the ancient world, they're opposing slavery, they're opposing name your female genital mutilation. Mm-hmm. If their culture's values are opposed to their proclamations, then those reformers are actually evil with respect to their culture. And there is no, again, sort of God's eye view of culture that says, well, this culture is just wrong. doesn't exist. That's one problem called the reformer problem. Another problem is I don't think we even accept that in practice. So if you go on to the average college campus, you'll see people that are very upset at injustices all over the mm-hmm. world. They'll be yes. waving signs and protesting and saying this is wrong about something that goes on somewhere in some other culture. And when I use this female genital mutilation mm-hmm. that happens not very much in the Western world, but it happens often in Asia and parts of Africa. Mm-hmm. And so the question would then be, how do you justify your moral outrage at their practices? Because in those cultures, what they're doing is traditional and accepted and therefore good. If you're a cultural relativist, you know, what gives you the right as a 21st century liberal, Westerner. Urban, educated, white, middle-class college student to impose your white, Western, American, 21st century, urban, progressive values on these Asian, indigenous, traditional cultures? Right, you have your culture. They have their. By what authority do you say that though that culture is bad, that culture is wrong for what they think is good? Well, that assumes you're assuming that there is some standard of morality to which all cultures are called. It is independent of what people believe. And again, that's what objective moral values and duties are. They sit in judgment. God's law sits in judgment on all cultures and calls all cultures to account. But if you're a cultural relativist, you can't do that. Mm-hmm. And the other view was what I call ethical subjectivism. And that's relativism, but it's individual. It says, okay, good and evil aren't relative to cultures. They're relative to the person. Every person has their own standard of good and evil. And so certain things are good to me and evil to me, and other things are good to you and evil to you. But it's all relative to the individual.
Like living your truth?
Well, yeah, well, but that's a little bit even more extreme because that's like your truth. Now we can't even decide whether or not, like, you know, to me, the earth is flat. But to you, the earth is spherical. So, you know, that's your truth. I have my truth.
Yeah.
This is just with respect to morality.
Yeah.
So not quite that extreme. But even here, the reformer problem turns up again. Because let's say you have, again, a reformer who's saying slavery is evil. Now, you might personally say, hey, his message is good to me, right? But the person who says, no, I reject that message. I own slaves. I think it's great. So his message is evil to me. Hmm. So you're okay. You can say the reformer is good, but you have no basis to criticize the person who says no to me. His message is evil. Like, there's no transcendent standard that calls all individuals to account. And again, the same problem, you know, when someone says, well, I'm a moral relativist, I think we all have our own standards of good and evil, right and wrong. But if you punch them in the face and take their wallet, they'll be like, how dare you? And you're like, well, I'm living my morality. My morality says it's fine to take your wallet. Mm-hmm. They don't accept that. So that people are just inconsistent here. No one really lives this way in practice. And thank God, truly thank God, that we're not consistent with these ideas. We can't live that way. And part of the reason is because God has put his law on our hearts. We know at some deep level that's not right. Our conscience is pulling us away from these evil behaviors. Even if we do them, we feel guilty then, because praise God that he's left that witness in our hearts saying, this is right, this is wrong. And what you're doing, you know it deep down inside is wrong.
Yeah. I remember an atheist once saying that basically that Christianity created morality. If you were to hear that though, from an atheist, you know, that Christianity basically imposes morality on people. What would your response be to that?
Well, so anthropologically, it's not true. Like you said, we just know there are, you know, right and wrong and good and evil. Those categories exist. They're like basic. It's like categories like color or sound. Like we experience it. We experience a moral realm, whether we can, you know, whether we have the resources to understand that within our worldview or not. We all bump into the furniture of morality in our mind, like in our experiences. We know, we just feel guilty. We know things are wrong. We know things are right. And so that's number one. But one thing I like to do, so one thing an atheist often say is, well, here's why we have those standards across culture of good behavior. Mm-hmm. We have them because of evolution. They'll argue, okay, because of evolution, if some group of human beings decided that murder was great and awesome, and we had this instinct to kill everybody, well, that group of human beings would die out. And the only groups that would be left after a while, after enough evolution, would be groups that said, hey, wait, murder is bad. Because if you believe that murder and rape and theft are great, then your civilization just dies. And so through both biological evolution and then more controversially through what's called group or cultural evolution, they'd argue that you end up with civilizations and cultures that all embrace these basic standards of right and wrong. That's a reasoning. That's how we got this. So they would say, yeah, okay, I agree. I have these instincts, like I shouldn't do this, I should do that. I have those instincts, but they're all illusions. They were foisted upon me by evolution. I can't control that. But that's why we all have those sensations, emotions. It's not because they're actually there. They're all the artifacts of our historical evolution. Okay, here's the problem. This is a good, and there are many objections to that claim, but here's a good one, or two good ones. Mm-hmm. They're thought experiments. The first one I call it is Cypher's Challenge. So if you watch the movie The Matrix, there's a character called Cypher, and he is given an offer by the villains in the movie to betray his friends, and so they'll all be killed. But in exchange, his memory will be erased. He won't remember betraying them, and he'll be given whatever life he wants. He's like, I want to be famous, like rich, and maybe a movie star. So they're going to wipe his memory of the betrayal, and they're going to give him whatever life he wants. Now, the question is this. What if I offered you that offer? I said to you, I'm going to give you, here's the challenge. you do something horrifically immoral. Like if you press this button, a busload of strangers in some foreign country will explode. You'll kill 100 people. You don't know them, but you press a button, it'll happen. But I will immediately wipe your memory of doing that, and then I'll give you whatever you want. Money, fame, success, happy family, you know, just do it. So now, do you take up that offer? Because you just said to me, well, morality is an illusion, mm-hmm. right? It's not really real. It's not objective right and wrong, good and evil. And so and you said, well, the reason I don't do those things is because, you know, I'd feel guilty. I wouldn't want to. I've had this illusion in my evolution. Yeah, but I'm going to erase that. I'm going to erase the memory of it. You'll do it and it'll be gone. Mm-hmm. So why not just do it? And I've asked people that question. They're like, I don't know. I'm like, well, what do you mean you don't know that? Well, would you do it? Like, no, I wouldn't do it. Well, why not? I just wouldn't do it. I'm like, well, but why? Okay, and here's another one. Here's a better one.
Yeah.
I call it the amorality pill. Imagine scientists invented a pill. You take the pill and it erases all your negative moral emotions. So no more guilt, no more shame, no more feeling bad and feeling guilty for not doing things. Just all that's just vanished. So you can still feel joy and happiness and love and all those positive things, but you'll never feel any negative moral emotions. Now, so to put it in stark terms, you know, you could still kiss your wife and play with your kids and read them story times and you know, and all those things you love. But if one day you decided that you'd rather be single again, you could just kill them all with an axe and throw their bodies in the fireplace and then just feel nothing and just go on and have a new life and do other things and have fun and never regret that. Would you take the pill? It wouldn't make you do bad things. It would just, if you did bad things, it wouldn't make you just wouldn't feel guilty. Mm-hmm. Do you take the pill? And again, atheists are like, no way. I'd be like a monster. Wait, why would you be a monster? If right and wrong are illusions, mm-hmm. why not get rid of them? Why not? In fact, you can do this in real life. You can, every day you can do little tiny things to numb your conscience. You can steal little things from the store and not get caught. You can key people's cars when no one's watching you. So you can do these things and you're like, well, I feel guilty. Yeah, but after a while, we know that we can dull our conscience. You all have done things that you first thought were bad. You kept doing them and doing them and doing them, and gradually your conscience stopped bothering you. But I'm saying go all the way then. If you think, well, these are illusions that are just cramping your style and helping you, keeping you from doing what you really, well, why not just do that? So you have no conscience anymore. And you can choose if you want to be a philanthropist, that's great, choose that. But you won't be guilted into it by your stupid illusory conscience. But people are like, no, I'd be a monster. I'm like, yes, you would be. Why? Because yeah. We know morality exists. That's why we can't answer those questions consistently with our relativism. I elaborate on that in the book, but that's helpful questions.
You talk about both of those examples in the book. Very interesting. And I love the examples you use. On page 131, you mentioned something I personally have never heard of before. And if I have heard of it, I fell out of my brain at one point. It's called the transcendental moral argument. What is this and why is it relevant to this chapter?
Sure. And you haven't heard of it because I haven't heard of it either, frankly. And okay. So I don't know. I made up the name.
Okay, good.
I did an interview with Sean McDowell where he said, I've never really heard of this argument either.
Yeah.
It's definitely not common. And so it's a variant on the moral argument, but it has to do with a particular obligation that we have, which is truth seeking. So here's the argument. I'll lay it out again, two premises and a conclusion. And it sounds very similar. So premise one, if a truth-loving God does not exist, then the truth is not intrinsically good and truth-seeking is not morally obligatory. So if there's no God, then truth is not intrinsically good and truth-seeking is not an obligation. Premise two, truth-seeking is, in fact, intrinsically good and truth-seeking is morally obligatory. Therefore, conclusion, a truth-loving God exists. So it's very similar to the moral argument, but we're looking at a particular obligation, a particular kind of good, which is truth is intrinsically good, and then we are obligated to seek the truth. Now, if I mean we're obligated to seek every truth in the universe, in the book, I'm like, no, we're not obligated to find out, like, you know, how many books do I have on my shelf? If I don't do that, I'm doing something wrong. If I don't count the books, that's wrong. I don't count the number of grains of sand on the beach. No. We're not obligated to seek all truth. It's all good to know truth is good, but we're not obligated to seek it. We're not doing bad things. We're like, well, I don't want to count the books. It's not obligatory. But some truth seeking I'm talking about is. So for example, the big questions in life, things like, is there a God? What are his commands for me? What is his purpose for me? Do I have any moral obligations? If I do, what are they? So there's like the big questions of life. I'm arguing that we're obligated to seek to know those truths. And now, as Christians, that's absolutely right. If you look at the Bible is like, truth is really important. Value it. Look at Proverbs. Value the truth more than gold or rubies or riches. In 2 Thessalonians, I think it's 2 Thessalonians, Paul, the highest criticism of he has for non-Christians is they refuse to seek the truth. They believe lies. So in the Bible, it's just throughout the Bible, the truth is super important, and we're obligated to seek to know God, to know that he exists, to know his will for us. So that's, if Christianity is true, it's clear too. So let's look at those premises. So is if a truth-loving God who commands us to know the truth, that does not exist, that kind of God doesn't exist, mm-hmm. then truth is not intrinsically good, and truth-seeking is not obligatory. You don't have to do it. Now, why would you believe that? Well, here's the problem. We talked about how atheists usually, if they say, well, there are moral truths, there are some moral truths out there. There's right and wrong, good and evil. They mm-hmm. often ground that, they explain that by appealing to human flourishing. They're like, well, what's good is what makes humans flourish. Mm-hmm. What's bad is what makes them, what harms them. And we ought to make people flourish. That's how they explain moral obligations. And so if that's your view, then how would you explain why truth-seeking is obligatory? You'd say, this is what you'd say. You'd say, well, here's why truth-seeking is obligatory. We should seek the truth because it will help us to cure cancer. It'll help us to feed the hungry. It'll help us build spacecrafts and travel to Mars and colonize the stars. So all those things will promote human flourishing. That's why truth is good. And that's why we ought to seek it. Okay, that's your explanation. Here's the problem. You've not made truth an intrinsic good, meaning it's not good for what it is. Mm-hmm. It's an instrumental good, meaning it's good insofar as it leads to other good things like human flourishing. So you say, why is truth seeking good? Oh, because it leads to this. Mm-hmm. Here's the problem with that explanation. Mm-hmm. If sometimes, so it makes truth an instrumental good. Well, what does that mean? Well, what else is good? Say, well, truth is good because it leads to human flourishing. Well, what else is good? Well, I don't know. Like papayas are good. Smooth jazz is good. Kenny G is good. Celine Dion music is good. Well, why? Well, it promotes human flourishing. They all promote human flourishing. Papayas and smooth jazz and Celine Dion. Say, wait a minute. I'm allergic to papayas. I hate smooth jazz. And I loathe Celine Dion. Oh, well, in that case, those things are not good because they don't promote your flourishing. Well, if an instrumental good, it's only good if it promotes the ultimate good, which is human flourishing. So what happens when truth itself doesn't promote human flourishing? For example, we have had an example of this before.
Yeah.
Before, if you have an affair and lie to your wife and lie to your mistress, mm-hmm. well, everybody's flourishing, everybody's happy. The truth would actually make them miserable. Right. So in that case, you're not obligated to tell them the truth, and they shouldn't seek the truth because it might ruin their lives.
Yeah.
And the example I use in the book is, imagine your grandmother's on her deathbed. She's incredibly sick and really hurting, but she's a Christian and you're an atheist. And so she calls you into her deathbed and she says, you know, I'm in terrible pain. I know I'm going to die soon. The only thing that's getting me through this misery is knowing that I will soon be with Jesus. I will get reunited with my husband who died before me, my little baby who died in infancy. I know I'll be with them. And that's the only thing that's making me able to just cope with the pain and giving me joy in the midst of the suffering. But atheist grandson, I hear that some people don't even believe in God. So I have a question for you. Is that true? Does God exist? So what do you do if you're an atheist who thinks the ultimate good is flourishing? Do you tell her the truth or do you lie to her? And the answer, I think, is you lie to her. If the ultimate good's flourishing, well, the truth will only make her miserable. So you just lie to her. Yeah, sure, Grandma. Christianity is totally true. And what about her? If she suspects there's no God, should she seek to know whether that's true? Well, if flourishing is the ultimate good, then I say no. She's about to die. The only thing giving her joy is this believing in this quote-unquote falsehood of Christianity. She actually should run from the truth because it'll just diminish her flourishing. So there's a case where truth and flourishing can flip. And then that's an individual level. It's very obvious. But what about societies? What if it turns out just psychologically that most people are miserable if they were to find out that atheism is true, they'd be miserable. If that were just psychologically, most humans need to believe in God. They just psychologically are miserable if they're an atheist. If that were just empirically true, then they should not seek to know that atheism is true. And if you're an atheist, you should hide the truth from them because you wouldn't want society to not flourish. And it gets worse. You're like, well, wait a minute. But real religions like Christianity, I'm an atheist. Well, I think Christianity and other and Judaism and Islam, those are all actually harmful. So we should get rid of those religions because they reduce human flourishing. Well, but here's the problem. You can always invent some made up religion that has some harmless, happy belief. Like, you believe everything that that science tells you, but you also believe that when you die, you're going to go to, I think in the book I call it pastry heaven, where you just live for eternity eating pies and eclairs and just having yummy food. So you believe everything, science tells you, but also you have this other belief. Everyone's going to die and go to pastry heaven. That's harmless. It's not going to hurt anybody. And it's making everyone happy. Everyone's happy. It's like, this is great. I love pie. Uh-huh. So if you're an atheist, you have to promote that false belief because it's making people happy. And if the ultimate goal is human flourishing, well, this any crazy, weird, but harmless, happy lie is increasing people's flourishing. You got to promote that. Another way to put it is this, if an atheist comes to me and says, you ought to seek to know the truth of atheism. Here's some books to read. Here's read Richard Dawkins, read Sam Harris, read Daniel Dennett. I've read all those books, but they'd say to me, you ought to seek to know that atheism is true. Uh-huh. I'd say, I ought to seek to know the truth. I should do it. What are you saying? I'm morally obligated to know the truth. Well, why do you say that? Because for me personally, objectively, being a Christian has made me happier. It's made me more generous, made me more loving, made me more forgiving. So I'm increasing my own flourishing. I'm increasing other people around me, their flourishing. But you're telling me, oh, seek the truth of atheism. Well, if you think atheism is the ultimate good as human flourishing, well, then no, I shouldn't do that. On your own worldview, I should not seek to know that it's true. Now, as a Christian, though, I can say to you, you ought to seek to know the truth of Christianity. And they say, well, it doesn't make me flourish. I don't care. Christianity does not ground goodness in flourishing. It grounds a goodness in God, and God commands you to seek the truth. And ironically, though, if Christianity is true, then in the end, truth and flourishing will meet and be in perfect concord because Jesus is the way, the truth, and the life. And so on Christianity, in the end, there'll be no conflict between truth and flourishing, but on atheism, there's a deep conflict. So ironically, atheists tend to really value truth and good for them. They have no way to explain why it's intrinsically good or why we ought to seek it, whereas Christians do mm-hmm. have reason to explain why it's good and why we ought to seek it. So it's a really interesting paradox.
Oh, man, this is fascinating. This is inside the mind of Dr. Neil Shenvey, if you guys want more of this, because I could sit here and talk to you about this all day.
One thing it's really helpful for, I think, is when Christians who are experiencing doubt, they're like, well, is Christianity even true? Is it maybe it's mm-hmm. all illusion or all a lie? Is it really? And I'd never be like, well, no, don't even think those thoughts. I'm like, yeah, bring your doubts, ask questions, ask people, ask pastors, ask. So that's, I'm not saying that. I'm saying absolutely we welcome questions, we welcome mm-hmm. Doubts. But the first thing I'd ask them is this, why do you want to know the truth?
Mm-hmm.
Why if you, are you happy being a Christian? And if they're like, well, yeah. Say, well, why even bother about the truth? And be like, oh, no, it's really important to seek the truth. I want to know the truth. And I'm like, yeah, but why? Why are you obligated to seek it? They're like, yeah, I think you really ought to seek the truth. Yeah, exactly. I agree. Why? Because God commands it. But if you're wondering, either is God even there? Well, ironically, if there's not a God, you're not obligated to find out. I agree with you. Absolutely, we're obligated to seek to know the truth of Christianity. We are because God commands it. But once you pull out God from the equation, mm-hmm. You're not obligated to ask those questions. You can just be happy as a Christian. So I'm not saying, oh, so just stop doubting, stop asking questions. I'm not saying that. I'm just mm-hmm. pointing out. You're asking those questions, assuming that truth is important and crucial and obligatory. You ought to seek it. And I agree with you. That's only true if God exists. Mm-hmm. So ironically, those very questions you have are pointing you to a God who commands you to ask, to seek him and know that he is there.
Yeah. Yeah, guys, this is fascinating. Just a reminder, this is only one chapter in Neil's book. Do you see, like, there's, it's so dense and filled with these types of topics. And I will leave a link in the description for you guys to check out. Dr. Shenvi, is there anything else that you'd like my viewers to know, where they can contact you, or any social media that you would like them to know about?
Yeah, you can just Google me, Neil Shenvi, S-H-E-N-V-I. I think I'm the only one in the world right now, at least. I'm on Twitter, Neil Shenvi, on Twitter. I'm on Twitter way too much, but you can contact me there. My emails, DMs are open, so I'm happy to answer your questions. But yeah, thank you so much, Melissa, for inviting me and for all these great questions.